Welcome, listeners. My name is Jen Schwab, and I'm an estate planning attorney in Denver, Colorado. And this is Deadly Testament, a true crime podcast that examines the dark side of inheritance and life insurance. Each episode tells the story of a murder or murders motivated by greed, from spouses who kill for money, to relatives who plot against each other, to strangers who target wealthy victims. Deadly Testament exposes the secrets and lies behind these crimes. Join us as we unravel the mysteries and uncover the evidence that led to justice. It has been way too long since I've given you a new episode, and I truly apologize. In what was supposed to be a brief hiatus, I ended up starting a new position at a great established law firm and closing my own firm, and selling my house to move to a smaller footprint with no mortgage. Yes, I'm just like Biggie Smalls, condo paid for, no car payment. Never mind that the rest of the lyrics of that song definitely do not describe me. Additionally, I became licensed in life insurance, for podcast purposes only, of course. I will try to get episodes up a lot more frequently than this, but in the meantime, here's a juicy story to hopefully get you back in the Deadly Testament mood, and it takes place in Australia. Well, I considered doing the entire episode using an Aussie accent, but no one wants to listen to that. I would sound like the inverse of Nicole Kidman, an Aussie actor who does the worst American accent ever. Besides, you got enough of my suppressed natural Chicago accent on the last episode. Okay, enough of that. Let's move on to the story. I now present to you Episode 5, Death Down Under. Janet Fisicaro, nicknamed Jenny, was born August 2, 1955, and grew up in a small town in New South Wales, Australia, called Deniliquin. Jenny was one of seven children in a very close-knit family. When Jenny and her siblings married and had families of their own, they all stayed in their small town with the exception of Jenny. Jenny had married Frank Fisicaro, whom she described as the love of her life, and when they married, Jenny moved to live with Frank on his farm just outside of town. Life on the farm was bliss, and soon Jenny and Frank had a son, Stephen. Sadly, in 1997, Frank had a heart attack and died at just 52 years old. Jenny was only 42 and widowed. After Frank's death, Jenny sold their farm and moved with now 14-year-old Stephen back to town, where she bought a house near her parents and sisters. Jenny's sister, Therese Rourke, said that Jenny would visit their mom, Val, several times a day, calling her in the morning and then going over for a cup of tea, a cuppa, as they call it in Australia. Jenny would also stop in every shop on the main street just to say hello to the shopkeepers, who all knew her because she was so friendly. Every Friday afternoon, Jenny and her sisters would get together at their mom's house for tea and cake. At this time, Jenny was working as an orderly at Deniliquin Hospital. It was there, in 2003, that she met an ambulance officer named Des Campbell. After a short period of getting to know one another, Des and Jenny began dating. Jenny kept the relationship a secret from her family members for quite some time. Her sisters had noticed, however, that Jenny was getting a lot of text messages, and when her phone would ring while she was having tea at her mom's house, Jenny would take the call outside. So they knew something was up, they just didn't know what. Finally, after Jenny had been dating Des for about 6 months, she invited her sisters over for tea and told them that she'd met someone, that he was just like her late husband Frank, and that she thought her sisters would love him. Shortly afterward, Jenny had her family over for dinner to meet Des. Despite Jenny's enthusiasm about the relationship and the comparisons she made between Des and Frank, Jenny's family found Des to be the polar opposite of Frank. According to Therese, quote, "He just sat there, he didn't mingle, and he didn't show any affection to her or make conversation," end quote. Now, it wasn't just Jenny's sisters who were unimpressed with him. When people in town started hearing that Jenny was seeing Des, they were seeking out Jenny's sisters to say things like, quote, "Tell Jenny not to be with him. He's a gold digger," end quote. He hadn't been there long, but had already earned a reputation as a money-hungry suitor, asking women about their net worth within the first 5 minutes of conversation. Jenny's sisters were understandably concerned by this and warned Jenny that he could be after her money. Jenny insisted that Des had changed and that he had the right to a second chance. According to Therese, Jenny was, quote, completely besotted with Des. 2 days after that family dinner, Jenny called her sisters to announce that she and Des were engaged. Therese asked Jenny what was the rush and whether Jenny truly knew Des. Jenny assured Therese it would be a long engagement, assuaging Therese's concerns. Shortly afterward, during a night out, Jenny's sister Mary, who worked with Jenny at the hospital, announced the engagement news to their co-workers. Des was furious. Apparently, it was supposed to be kept a secret, and the engagement was called off. According to Jenny, Des didn't want the world to know he was engaged. Let's take a brief detour so I can tell you a bit about Des before we continue with Des and Jenny's story. Desmond Campbell was born in 1958 in the UK, but grew up in Australia. He worked for the Victoria Police Force until he was fired for using illegal force against suspects and fabricating evidence. In 1995, he moved to the UK to work for the Surrey Police Department. He didn't learn from his mistakes in Victoria, and he continued to behave badly in Surrey, both professionally and personally, including being accused of sexual assault by a girlfriend and being investigated for insurance fraud. He was also known by coworkers and higher-ups as a serious womanizer. In 1998, he left the Surrey Police Department and then decided to expose the extreme corruption happening within. When he spoke about his actions as a police officer, he stated, quote, "I was as bad as the criminals I was arresting," end quote. But honestly, if he was assaulting suspects and fabricating evidence, I'm going to say he was absolutely worse than them. Later, he stated, quote, "Looking back, I was just scum. I became like the people I was arresting. It was my fault. If I had been a better person and a stronger person, I might have resisted, but I wouldn't have been able to stay in the police force. You couldn't be an effective policeman if you didn't lie to get around legal restrictions," end quote. So why did he decide to expose the corruption? Did he magically develop a conscience? According to Des, that's exactly what happened. He said, quote, "It took me years after I left the police to suddenly reflect on how I was before I joined and how I was when I left. I was shocked at what I had become," end quote. I mean, I suppose that could be the truth, or more likely, he was under investigation for his own bad behavior and realized that he could turn on his former department to get out of that trouble. Nonetheless, that would be the end of his career in law enforcement, and within a couple years, he had moved back to Australia. He began working as a paramedic in Deniliquin, where he would soon meet Jenny. He was still engaged to a woman named June Ingham when he met Jenny, but he didn't let that get in the way. Des and June met in 1997 while Des was still living in Surrey. June was married, but carried on an affair with Des for several years before finally divorcing her husband. By this time, Des had already moved back to Australia, but June, who still lived in Surrey, visited him there often. In 2001, when her divorce was final, June decided to move to Australia to be with Des permanently. Like Jenny, June was well off and had already given Des $64,500 for a Lotus sports car on the promise that the two would move in together. Des then sold the Lotus and used some of the money to pay for a down payment on a house and kept the rest. After loading up all of her belongings and getting on a boat to Australia, June was devastated to receive a text message from Des that said, quote, I'm sorry, but I'm moving to live with my ex-wife. We'll sell house and send you money. Post me address for things to be sent to you. Have made up mind to do this," end quote. But Des didn't repay June the money, and eventually June sued him for $40,000. Can you even imagine this? A trip by boat from the UK to Australia, which really is kind of necessary if you're moving and you need to bring a lot of belongings, usually takes 32 to 40 days. So basically, she was looking at over a month on this boat, only to discover that the person she was moving to be with had moved on himself, and she was carting all of her stuff toward nothing at all. What a complete waste. And via text message? They had been together for about 5 years at this point. I cannot imagine ending a long-term relationship like that via text message and ending it with, quote, have made up mind to do this, end quote, as if to say, there will be no further discussion. We're finished. Unreal. Des had been married twice before he met June. His first marriage, to Faye Campbell, ended in November 1991, and he married his second wife, Gwen Collins, only 4 months later in Las Vegas. I was unable to find any information on when Des's marriage to Gwen ended, but presumably it was a short-lived marriage because he left Australia just a few years later. His many girlfriends during these years described Des pretty much the same way. He was after their money, he had a violent temper, and he would love them and leave them. He was the ultimate womanizer. Although Jenny was dazzled by Des, and he did his absolute best to charm her, at the same time, he was giving his friends and relatives a very different impression of how he felt about Jenny. To them, Des would say things such as Jenny was a fat, ugly pig, a fat, ugly slut, and pig ugly, and said he didn't know if he could bring himself to, quote, shag her. Wow. Real nice. So now that Des had weaseled his way into Jenny's life, it was time for him to get to work. Jenny was unfortunately very open with Des about her inheritance of her late husband's estate, worth about $500,000, and even though Des thought Jenny was fat and ugly, he sure found her wealth incredibly attractive. So where we left off in Des and Jenny's story, Des and Jenny had broken up after the news of their engagement became public. Right after the breakup, Des began seeing a woman named Gorica Felikansky. He would continue to see Gorica, but in April of 2004, Jenny gave Des $2,500 and their engagement was magically back on. Unfortunately, Jenny was now very secretive about her relationship, shutting out her sisters even as she planned her wedding. Des really did a number on her emotionally, making poor Jenny feel as if the only way to keep him in her life was to keep their relationship a secret. In May of 2004, Des spent a weekend with an old flame named Linda Rogers. Did Jenny know about this weekend? It's hard to say. What happens behind closed doors is anyone's guess, and there are many couples who have agreements in place regarding monogamy, but it's probably fair to say that Jenny didn't know about Linda. Or Gorica, for that matter, whom Des was still seeing. In June of 2004, Jenny gave Des a whopping $23,000, which he used to pay off credit cards, even though he told her it was to pay off the mortgage on his parents' house in Bendigo. On September 17, 2004, at the River Gallery Inn in Echuca, New South Wales, Des and Jenny were married in secret. The only guests were two staff members from the inn. Even Jenny's son, Stephen, now an adult, was unaware that his mother had gotten married. The officiant, Jennifer Whalen, said that Jenny appeared sad when she asked her about her son and family not being at the wedding. Not a single photo was taken. A week after the wedding, Jenny changed her will, leaving $100,000 to Stephen and designating the remainder of her estate to be divided equally between Des and Stephen. A few weeks later, Jenny bought a house for Des and herself in Otford, several hours away from Deniliquin, near the Sydney Royal National Park, just up the coast from Wollongong. Even though Jenny purchased the house with her own money and no contribution from Des, she put the house in both their names. Jenny continued to live in Deniliquin for some time, but Des quickly moved into the Otford house and spent a good amount of time there without Jenny. During this time, Des certainly wasn't lonely, often having one of his three girlfriends stay over with him at Jenny's house. Gorica stayed multiple times, and Jeanette Aldred stayed at least once. Curiously, when Jeanette stayed over, Gorica stayed over just one day later, on March 17, 2005. On the same day Gorica was sleeping in Jenny's bed with Jenny's husband, just 6 months after Des and Jenny's wedding day, Jenny finally told her mother and Stephen that she and Des had gotten married. The next day, she moved to Otford to live with Des. Less than a week later, Jenny was dead. Over Easter weekend, Des and Jenny went camping in Sydney's Royal National Park. Around dusk on March 24, 2005, Jenny fell from a cliff a little over 50 yards high near their campsite. Des claimed that Jenny had left their tent to go to the toilet, lost her footing, and tripped off the cliff. Jenny died from her injuries. The next day, police interviewed Des. Initially, the police suspected that Jenny had taken her own life, but Des assured them that was not the case. That seems strange, right? If the police believed it was a suicide, it would keep Des in the clear, wouldn't it? Well, as it turns out, Des already knew that the life insurance policy on Jenny's life would not pay out if she died by suicide, so he had to make sure it was ruled an accident so he could get his grubby little hands on the life insurance death benefit. Meanwhile, the day after Jenny's death, the police informed her family. Upon hearing the news, Jenny's sister, Therese, asked, "How did he do it?" Therese had no doubt Des had killed Jenny and had always suspected that Des would hurt her. 5 days later, while still portraying himself as a despondent husband mourning the loss of the love of his life, Des was booking a getaway to Townsville, a destination spot in northeastern Australia near the Great Barrier Reef. Was he going alone? Well, by now you should know he absolutely was not. He was treating Gorica to a vacation on Jenny's dime. In Townsville, he introduced people to Gorica as his wife. Also at this time, he was working on cashing in on the life insurance policy on Jenny's life and getting the process started to collect his inheritance by reaching out to Jenny's estate attorney. On April 6th, 2005, Jenny's family held a funeral for Jenny in Deniliquin, which Des did not attend. Not that they wanted him there anyway, but still. A month later, Des jet-setted off to the Philippines to meet up with Melissa, a former nightclub singer he met on the internet. Melissa would eventually become Des's fourth wife in January 2006, less than 9 months after Jenny's death. In the meantime, not buying Des's grieving widow routine for a moment, the police investigation into Jenny's death continued. A physics expert determined that the crime scene showed no signs of Jenny falling to her death. Instead, he said, the evidence pointed towards her being pushed from the cliff. A pathologist said the bruising on Jenny's upper arms suggested that a strong man had held her tightly by the top of her arms. This correlated with the police's theory that Des had roughly grabbed Jenny and pulled or shoved her to the edge of the cliff before pushing her off of it. In addition to these expert opinions, police had collected forensic evidence and testimony from Jenny's family and the wedding officiant. Despite knowing how Jenny died and having a strong theory about who was responsible, It took over 4.5 years before police finally had enough evidence to charge Dez with Jenny's death in October 2009. Dez didn't testify at trial, and he showed almost no emotion, with the exception of his reaction to the police interview video. In the video, Dez described how he used a rope from his backpack to climb down the cliff to find Jenny's body. He said, quote, "It looked like she was sitting in a chair, but she was on the rocks." At this, Dez broke down in tears. In that interview, he also called Jenny's family controlling and said that they interfered in his marriage. Dez was eventually found guilty at trial. Before sentencing Dez to up to 33 years in prison with a 24-year period in which he was ineligible for parole, the judge said, "There can be no doubt that the circumstances under which Janet met her death demonstrate the offender's sustained callousness towards her for nothing more than monetary gain. The offender took the life of an outgoing, generous, warm-hearted, and somewhat naive middle-aged country woman as soon as it became clear he had obtained as much financial gain from the relationship as he could." The judge went on to say, "Such a statement fails to capture the offender's capacity for deception, duplicity, manipulation, and cruelty." Jenny's sister told reporters, quote, "We spent years trying to get the answer we wanted, that he was guilty, that he was going to spend his life in jail. It helped with getting my sister justice, the justice she deserved," end quote. Immediately after his conviction, Dez began working on his appeal. The appeal largely rested on a tactic from a similar case in which a woman named Caroline Byrne had been found dead at the bottom of a cliff that was well known as a spot where people would take their lives. Caroline's boyfriend, Gordon Wood, was eventually arrested, charged, and convicted of her death. In that trial, as in Dez Campbell's trial, police relied on the testimony of physics expert and former professor Rod Cross. At Gordon Wood's appeal, the 3-judge panel found that there was not enough evidence to find Gordon guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and overturned his conviction. One of the arguments which Dez Campbell's lawyers used on his appeal was that Professor Cross's expertise was not relevant to the type of fall involved, especially as it related to a shoe print Dez left at the crime scene. The 3-judge panel was not swayed, and Dez's appeal was dismissed. Although the judges agreed that Professor Cross's expertise in this area was not well established, the judges were nonetheless satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that Dez was guilty based on all the other evidence presented at trial. An important distinction between Gordon's trial and Dez's trial was that there was not sufficient evidence to establish Gordon was even at the scene of Caroline's death, while conversely, Dez was undoubtedly present when Jenny was killed. After losing his appeal, Dez remains in prison today. He is ineligible for parole until 2034. So, listeners, what do you think? Was Dez really a loving husband who couldn't help himself around other women? Did he kill Jenny for her money, or did she find out he was cheating and throw herself off that cliff? Personally, I think the evidence leaves little doubt that justice was served. Poor Jenny. She just wanted to find love again after losing her dear husband, Frank. I can't imagine how hard it must be for her family, knowing that Dez was up to no good all that time, and being helpless to stop it. Such a tragedy. Please share your thoughts either on my Spotify page or on the Deadly Testament Facebook page. And stay tuned for another episode of Deadly Testament coming soon. I promise. I pinky promise. Thanks for listening.